Mr. Hayden and also Mr. Forster. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sign in while I have a fence here. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, if I may.
Certainly.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Charles Hayden, and I represent Francisco Hernandez, who entered Alford pleas of guilty to 8 felony counts. The issue that was assigned as error was that the trial court erred in denying Hernandez's motion to withdraw the Alford pleas, where the request was made well prior to sentencing and therefore wasn't required to show manifest necessity, the manifest injustice to have the request granted, and he otherwise met the criteria for allowing withdrawal of the pleas. The defense counsel, Ms. Bailey, had filed a motion explaining her reasons for filing the motion to withdraw the She said that in preparing for the sentencing event, I noticed there was a mix-up in the dates of the orders and that there were these conflicting opinions by Dr. Earl Williams concerning Hernandez's sanity during the time frame the offenses were committed. I realized that I misadvised Hernandez to plead guilty. After looking at the sanity evaluations again and reviewing the record more thoroughly and preparing for sentencing, I noticed he had a substantive defense that he was NGRI, not guilty by reason of insanity. And so I filed this motion to withdraw Hernandez's Alford pleas. And she goes on to explain that that this was something that that she did. It was not some manipulation on the part of Mr. Hernandez. It wasn't something where he was pressing her to file this plea. It's something she realized on her own. There's no indication in the record that I can see of any lack of good faith on the part of the defendant that he was trying to manipulate the court, anything like that. The defense counsel goes on to say that she noted the Paris standard allows a defendant to withdraw his guilty plea in situations where the defendant would not have pled guilty but for some external circumstance.
Mr. Hayden, if I might interrupt, the Attorney General said there's no reasonable defense basically because trial court said it found that Dr. Papadaki, however you pronounce it, believed that he was sane. How does that... what is the effect of the trial court making a credibility finding as to these competing medical reports?
Well, for one thing, Dr. Papadake didn't say that he was insane at the time. What he says is, asked to explain his reason why he felt Hernandez did not meet the criteria for an insanity defense, he explained, quote, "For one thing, my opinion wasn't that he was not insane. It was that he was insane, but that was not relevant to his behavior at the time." Come again? But that's what the doctor's opinion was. He says he was off his medication. And yes, he does have a history that's consistent with mental health history, and the nature of that disorder is such that it's chronic. But his behavior at the time was not influenced by that mental illness. Come again? I'm trying to understand how can a person, he says he's insane, but it doesn't influence his behavior at the time.
Mr. Hayden, didn't the other doctor, there are 3 different doctors. There's a doctor from Central State that essentially indicated that Mr. Hernandez was sort of delaying the process of being restored to competency, and then when he was advised of that, whether he was dragging it out, he sort of smiled and nodded his head. And then the other doctor who did the evaluation that the defense attorney was relying on actually had 2 conflicting sort of report. So the trial court had the ability, one saying that he was sane at the time of the offense, one saying that he's not sane at the time of the offense. So to rephrase the question, how is the court's determination of all of these factors that there wasn't a viable defense of not guilty by reason of insanity not, or how is it an abuse of discretion?
Because the trial court failed to apply the standards that set forth in the Paris Justice and Bottoms case, and that is that the least influence causing a defendant to plead guilty when he has any defense at all should be sufficient grounds for permitting a change of plea. The change of plea should not be denied in any case where it's in the least evident that the ends of justice will be served by permitting not guilty to be pleaded in its place. Leave should be granted to withdraw the plea of guilty if it was entered for any reason, any reasonable ground is offered for going to the jury, unquote. I'm quoting the Paris case and repeatedly citing. So that's the standard that the judges reply. And so there was absolutely, a reasonable grounds offered of, and the showing of influence of a reason that the plea was entered in good faith but inadvisedly because the attorney was telling him at the time, well, we don't have any, we can't raise the defense of not guilty by reason of insanity, unaware of these conflicting. She told him, your choice is either enter into a plea agreement or you're going to go to trial on this thing and you're going to end up getting hammered by a jury with no available NGRI defense. That's what she advised him. That's what she says. No evidence of manipulation on the part of the defendant. So that's the standard. And despite the standard, the judge just says, I'm disregarding the standard. I'm going to presume somehow that there's a lack of good. He didn't say that. He just says, I accept Dr. Papadake's opinion and as more credible than the other doctor, Dr. Williams. But if you look at the doctor, Dr. Papadake himself is saying the defendant is guilty, or rather is insane, how is it that he says, but I know that his behaviors while he was insane were the result of reasoned decision. Apparently the right brain is insane, but the left brain was the same one that did the act.
Didn't he base that determination upon answers to questions that he had asked about the specific offense, where he was able to lay out pretty much specifically what had occurred and determining his ability to understand what had occurred at the time?
The doctor, Papadake, says, well, he says, I believe he was insane, but that's not relevant to his behavior at the time. It did not cause the behavior. It was the drug use. Somehow he takes the drugs and that makes him sane?
Tell us what page that is.
It's on page 179 of the appendix. That's where he's stating this. He's saying that I believe he was insane. And he says, and also where he earlier says, for one thing, my opinion wasn't that he was not insane. It was that he was insane. But that behavior was not relevant. And he says that on page 177. So he goes on to say, Dr. Papadake says, he describes that, well, he was telling me about these hallucinations that he was having, but they were not command in nature. The person, he was hearing voices, they just weren't telling him to commit this crime. And he says, they weren't commanding them to him. And therefore, it would not have influenced how he was behaving. Come again?
But I guess, Mr. Hayden, my question is, why does the trial court credibility finding have any impact on whether he has a viable defense? I mean, ultimately, the jury decides, or the fact finder decides, insanity.
That's extra correct. But this was a viable defense that the defendant was misadvised was not a viable defense. He's just simply told incorrectly advised by the defense counsel. And the defense counsel acknowledged it, freely admits this. She said, this is not an issue of a lack of good faith. This is something I realized, and I'm going to follow my sword here, is how she phrased it, but acknowledged it was all my fault. And it's not the defendant's doing that. That this defense wasn't asserted earlier. So if the judge is going to, they clearly set forth the standard here of that he meets the criteria set forth in Paris. The judge can choose to disregard that if he believes that the defendant is acting in bad faith or that he's manipulating the court in some way. But there has to be some factual basis for making that determination in the record, which is absolutely, there is no facts in the record to support that. The AG asserts it was bad faith and it must be some type of manipulation on the part of Hernandez, but I would defy them to cite a specific statement that he makes at any of the plea hearings to withdraw that is the basis for the assertion that Hernandez was not acting in good faith. There is no. That's just simply. So that's why the judge's ruling is plainly wrong and without evidence to support it. There was no factual basis for concluding that Hernandez was trying to manipulate the court or deceive the court. There was zero evidence of that. It's all the evidence is, the only evidence, the uncontroverted evidence before the court, defense attorney made a serious screw-up. I can understand the judge's frustration that the defense attorney was kind of going back and forth and not recollecting, not realizing these defenses should have been done before, but, you know, she acknowledged that where the fault lay, and when that happened, and that's uncontroverted, that's the reason for the pleas being entered inadvisedly. Are we going to disbelieve the attorney's reasons? I mean, in the absence of any evidence to the contrary. Thank you. I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Hayden.
Please the court, Stephen Forster on behalf of the Commonwealth. I would like to start by saying that this court should affirm the trial court's determination denying the defendant.
Mr. Forster, do you agree that this appellant was given erroneous advice from counsel?
I do not agree with that, Your Honor. And the reason being is that the record doesn't support the defendant's position that this was misadvisedly so, that she didn't have knowledge of these reports. This wasn't a situation where counsel came in and simply had Dr. Papadoc's report and had no notice of these other two reports.
So you're saying that despite his attorney's legal advice that you have no insanity defense, he should have said, oh, I disagree with you because I, you know, got a GED and I know the law, and therefore I need to disregard your legal advice?
I wouldn't say that he should have said that to his attorney, Your Honor. However, when we look at the record, I believe the record establishes that he was well aware that he wanted to move forward on this not guilty by reason of insanity defense, and the counsel was more than aware of all three insanity reports prior to pleading guilty the second time.
Counselor, are you indicating that simply because there are mental health evaluations that automatically counsel is going to know that there's going to be a defense of not guilty by reason of insanity?
No, Your Honor. I'm not saying the counsel would automatically know that. What it appears by the record is that through her several motions, both orally and then a non-thorough motion. So if we look at the record, counsel 9/21/12, or I should say 7/18/12, defendant files this motion. He wants a defense by not guilty by reason of insanity. Ms. Bailey is appointed counsel. She comes into court. She requests that the court grant a continuance so she can file a motion for a defense, not guilty by reason of insanity. On 10-22-12, she files this motion. On 10-23-12, she comes in and explains to the court, that motion wasn't thorough enough. I'd like more time to review the record and file a more thorough response and motion so that the Commonwealth can then respond. On 11-9-12, she files the second written motion for the court. And on 2-8-13, there's a hearing held on the motion to withdraw the guilty pleas. And Ms. Bailey comes in and she states, there were, quote, there were conflicting sanity reports. He wants to plead not guilty by reason of insanity. And that's the 2-8-13 hearing transcript, page 3. She goes on to say, when the Commonwealth proffers, it's the same doctor who gave conflicting reports. So it would be the concern of the Commonwealth. I don't think you can pick and choose which report you want to rely on. I think the better practice would be to have a report completed by a doctor to make a determination to go forward. It would be the Commonwealth's suggestion that a trial date be set. Then there is another motion by Ms. Bailey for competency and insanity, and she says, that's fine. And I think what these indicate is that she's more than aware of these reports. She's aware that Dr. Williams has made a finding of sanity.
But let's assume that's correct. She still advised him that he had no insanity defense. Now, is it your position that this appellant should disregard her attorney's advice?
No, Your Honor. Not that the defendant should disregard his attorney's advice. However, when we look to the reasonableness of this defense, I think we need to get into what the reports actually say and what the court indeed did consider.
We're talking about separate issues.
Okay.
Number one, if he got bad legal advice, then he ought to be able to withdraw his plea, assuming that there's good faith and that there's a viable defense and there's no prejudice. So it's really a multi-step analysis. So you have moved away from whether he got bad advice to whether there's a viable defense.
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand the court's question. I would say that if the court is in the position that he did get bad advice in this case, and assuming that he did get bad advice from his attorney, then we would move to the reasonableness of this defense and whether or not he should be able to withdraw a guilty plea the second time. And I would point the court to the language in Pritchett versus Commonwealth, because it seems that this gets into the dilatory tactic, the first argument put forth by the Commonwealth, as well as the reasonableness of the defense. And in Pritchett, the court specifically stated that the guilty plea must be entered into inadvisedly, i.e., there must be a reason to set aside the guilty plea beyond the mere existence of the defense. And then it goes on to state, otherwise, a defendant could plead guilty with full knowledge of an available defense to gain delay or for some other tactical reason, and then set the plea aside simply by tendering the defense of the charges. So in this particular instance, we have, you know, as far as a dilatory tactic on the defendant's part, he files himself, his attorney files multiple motions, the motion is granted, the court withdraws it, attorney files multiple other motions, comes in, has a full evidentiary hearing, and then still decides to plead guilty after having all the reports, and then wants to withdraw the pleas a second time. And we're talking about essentially a 4 to 5 year period since the offenses took place. And this just appears to be a bit of gamesmanship in terms of, we're going to consider all the evidence, the Commonwealth's going to make their plea agreement, we're going to come into court, plead guilty, and then say, I want this defense again. We come back a second time and we try to do the same defense all over again. And I think that's essentially what the trial court was trying to deal with in part. But again, now if we can transition into the reasonableness of this defense with respect to what the insanity reports and evaluations actually state. When we look at Dr. Williams' report, and I think this is what the trial court really struggled with in terms of whether or not this not guilty by reason of insanity defense was even viable at the time. I point the court to pages 263 of the transcript. It's 267 and 268. And when we look at the language of this report, which is an issue, first, the report states it's with respect to the probation violation and not these skip-with offenses, the robbery and all the other charges. Even moving beyond that, it says, it is possible that Mr. Hernandez was psychotic during the first week. Possible is not a definitive determination. It says, it appears that he did not have the ability to tell right from wrong. because of his assumed psychotic episode, again, we're looking at this language of possible, appears, assumed. And then when we take that and we juxtapose that with the report of Dr. Papadak, it's very definitive, his findings. And to get to the court's question earlier as to the findings of Dr. Papadak and whether or not he knew and whether or not it was the drugs and dealing with the, you know, what was in the transcript, Dr. Papadak goes into great detail regarding why he made the findings that he found in terms of the defendant's sanity at the time of the skip with offenses. And to get to, I believe it was Judge Malvo's question, he specifically states, it says, the writers of the opinion that while the defendant does suffer from mental illness, however, he reports not experiencing symptoms on the day of the alleged incident. Very specific finding. He was using illicit substances on that day, which could have influenced his thoughts and behaviors to an unknown extent. Lastly, he refused to answer certain questions, which indicates that he is currently aware of his behaviors. This consistent with his telling the writer that while involved in the break-in, he knew it was wrong and wanted to leave. Now, those are very specific findings as to his mental state, as to his sanity at the time of these offenses. And again, we get into the testimony in the transcript where the court is making this credibility determination of Dr. Williams versus Dr. Papadak. The court relies heavily on this language. And the court, you know, states Dr. Williams has multiple reports. One is sanity, one is insanity. There's this inconsistent language.
Well, how does the judge's finding that he accepted Dr. Papadak's finding, how does that impact on whether or not he had a viable defense?
Well, Your Honor, if we look to whether or not he has a viable defense with respect to insanity, in Virginia, the accused must prove to the satisfaction of the fact finder by preponderance of the evidence, and that's White versus Commonwealth. And it says the trial court may bar a defendant from presenting an insanity defense if the evidence does not establish a prima facie case that the defendant was legally insane at the time of the incident. And in this particular case, I believe the court weighed that and said Dr. Williams' report is insufficient to establish a prima facie case, although that's not the language that is used.
So your position is the trial court has to make a threshold in order to determine whether there's a viable defense. The trial court has to make a threshold determination of credibility of conflicting reports.
Well, in this particular instance, I would say yes, Your Honor. That would be the position of the Commonwealth. And again, going back to that language that I discussed earlier, that the court is taking a report that is making significant assumptions, assuming that he was psychotic. You know, I mean, these are things that doctor was specifically hired to make those findings. And when you compare the two reports in this case, with the other report from Dr. Williams saying that there was a sanity, that the trial court, I believe, made that threshold finding and didn't was of the opinion that it should not that it wasn't sufficient enough to be a viable and reasonable defense.
Talk to us about prejudice. You had raised that issue in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the prejudice, in this particular instance, again, going back to this, the historical timeline, again, these offenses, I believe, took place in 2011, and at that point, I think it was actually on 5/28/11 was the offense date. The first plea was entered on 5/8/12, and again, there was a plea on all the charges. And then we move forward, and we're now looking at the second plea agreement, which is in 6/11/2013. So we're 2 years down the road, and the Commonwealth null-prossed several charges. Defendant entered Alford plea with respect to the breaking and entering, abduction, two counts of attempted robbery, and four related counts of use of a firearm. And then the remainder of those charges were null-prossed. And looking at the language of Pritchett versus Commonwealth, 61 VA App 777-2013, it says trial courts should consider whether allowing the defendant to withdraw his guilty would prejudice the prosecution. And in this particular instance, the Commonwealth has put its case forward, has agreed to null-pros certain charges, has gone through the extent of preparing for trial, and then not going to trial. And now we're in 2015. And whether or not they can get witnesses, getting evidence forth, some of this is going to be
stale.
But
is there any evidence that would be a problem?
Nothing in the record, I believe, demonstrates
that. Did the trial court ever rule on prejudice?
I do not believe the trial court did rule on prejudice, Your Honor. Again, the Commonwealth would ask this court to affirm the trial court's determination for three reasons. First, this is a dilatory tactic on part of the defendant. Second, there was no reasonable defense based on the definitive report of Dr. Papadoc and the insufficient report of Dr. Williams, and the fact that there would be prejudice to the Commonwealth. And if the court has no further questions, I'll return my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hayden.
I submit as speculative that the Commonwealth would suffer any prejudice by allowing the withdrawal of the guilty plea. There's no evidence that witnesses are no longer available or moved, and that evidence has been destroyed or lost. There's no reason why they can't simply go to trial again. I would note that the Cobbins case that was cited in the AG's brief is supposed to be right on point. In that case, the trial judge made a specific finding that Cobbins was acting in bad faith and that he entered his guilty plea to buy time and was engaging in duplicitous conduct, and the judge wasn't going to reward his conduct. But that kind of evidence is entirely absent here. There's no evidence that Hernandez was the person behind this.
Did the trial court ever make a finding that there was no viable defense other than commenting on Papadoc's conclusion?
No, I don't think he did. All he said was that I find Papadoc to be more credible than Dr. Williams, and that's all he said. And that may mean that he was possibly looking ahead to, if it came down to an insanity defense. But, when you look at what Papadoc was saying himself, he's saying he's insane, but he took drugs, and that somehow rendered him insane, but it was the drugs that made him do this, is what he says. I think his ingestion of drugs changed his behavior, and it changed my opinion. I believe he was insane, but that's not relevant to his behavior. It did not cause the behavior. It was the drug use. How does taking illegal drugs while insane somehow render the person sane? This Dr. Papadoc said, I went out to see him at the jail for 1 hour. I'd never bothered to contact the attorney to ask for the prior. I was entirely unaware of the prior psychiatric history, the history of frequent mental hospitalizations. I was entirely unaware of Dr. Williams's reports and all the others. So I didn't attempt to get any psychiatric or medical. I just went in for 1 hour and talked with him. He said he was sorry about what he had done, and because he expressed remorse, that meant he knew what he was doing when he did the offense. He's on medication when he's talking to a doctor at the jail. And he's rationally saying, no, I feel bad about what I did.
Mr. Hayden, is it your position that the trial court's factual finding of Dr. Papadoc's credibility, that he didn't have that privilege to make the finding, or that his finding was based on erroneous testimony?
When the doctor gets on the stand and admits that he says, I think he was insane, but the reason I said it didn't influence his behavior was he took some drugs, on the face of it, that's not a testimony that can be relied upon to conclude, well, right,
so
therefore
gather,
there's no NGRI defense.
I gather then that you don't have a problem with the trial court making threshold findings as to credibility of the evidence. You're simply saying that there was nothing to support the trial court's finding of credibility. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that's correct. If there are no other questions, I'll just rest.
Thank you, Mr. Hayden. We'll come down and greet counsel.